Don't you wonder what that day is going to be like when you see God on the throne? I mean, if Progressive Field can be lights out when just 30,000 are in the stands there, can you imagine what it's going to be like when you really appear before your Maker on the throne and all of creation? The angels, the humanity, the creatures themselves are just singing out the praises to their Maker, to their God. What a day that's going to be. What a day that's going to be. I'm thankful for these opportunities of worship where we're elevated to catching a glimpse of what God's up to with the hope of all eternity in mind. I'd invite you at this time to open up your Bibles to Luke 16. Luke 16 is where we're going to be kind of camping out later today, and we'll get there in just a moment. But boy, have we been tackling some issues here as of late. Some ballot issues, but they were biblical issues long before they were ballot issues. And so in the last couple weeks, about the last month together, we've been really tackling some tough subjects together. It started with Jesus himself when he was confronted with the political issue of his day. The Republicans and Democrats of Jesus' day, by the name of Sadducees and Herodians, came and approached Jesus, and they asked him a tough political question. And in that tough political question, Jesus didn't shy away from taking a political stance. But in the midst of that political stance, he helped illumine to what God was up to in that stance. And so kind of following that outlet, we've been trying to take some ballot issues of our day and putting them in a biblical perspective. Why do Christians hold this view on this matter? And so we've tackled some tough issues along those routes in terms of the sanctity of life and abortion. We covered that one of the weeks. We covered race relations another week in the wake of some recent news there with Ferguson, Baltimore, Dallas, and race riots there in our own nation. What is a Christian stance on race relations? And then last week we covered the tough issue of human sexuality and particularly the definition of marriage and why did God design our bodies in such a way where sexuality is such a marquee moment there. So we've been tackling some really tough issues, and today we want to finally tackle one last issue in terms of the economy together. I'd intended, knowing that these were tough issues before we had engaged in this sermon series, I had intended of sprinkling some trivia, some presidential trivia throughout our sermon series, but they just didn't seem fitting for the sermons prior to this. So I want to revisit that. I had asked my cousin, he's big time into presidential trivia. Like I'm talking about, he reads presidential biographies. For vacation spots, he goes to presidential libraries. And so, I mean, he is big time into presidential trivia itself. So I asked him before the sermon series, I said, can you just toss a few trivia questions my way? We'll probably sprinkle them throughout. And so I want to present you with some of those. I even got some leftover trunk or treat candy, if you know some of these responses, okay? We even got some here. So let's test our presidential knowledge, realizing it's a big presidential week for us this week. First question here. Let's see if we know the answer to this. What? What was that? Oh my goodness. She hammered it. People that aren't even seeing the question. Watch yourself here today. The question was if we had any chance of reading that, okay? What two presidents died 50 years after the Declaration of Independence in 1826 there? And the answer, before even the multiple, she's no more answering, okay, Kate? Kate loves history herself, has history background there. So she got that first one. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson died 50 years after they both had a signature in that original Declaration of Independence. Next question for everyone but Kate. This president lost the White House China collection in a poker game. Which president lost the White House China in a poker game? I thought we might need multiple choice. Kate's just belting out the answers before we can even get them up there, though. Your questions, your answers. Honest Abe Lincoln, what if he poker game lost to China? Warren Harding, Grover Cleveland, or Andrew Jackson? Which one lost the White House China in a poker game? Harding, with the first response I got was over there. Harding was the man. He should have been a Methodist, right? He wouldn't have lost the White House China in a poker game there. Harding was the man, representing Ohio proud, right? What U.S. president got a speeding ticket on a horse? Get this. A speeding ticket on a horse. Was it George Washington? Was it Paul Revere? Was it James Madison? Or was it Ulysses S. Grant? Grant was the man. Survey says Grant. Who said Paul Revere? Anyone? Go back to the history books, people, okay? What U.S. president was credited with coming up with the phrase, okay? Was it Benjamin Harrison? Was it Woodrow Wilson? Was it Harry S. Truman? Or was it Martin Van Buren? Which of these presidents came up with the phrase, okay? Truman? Nope. Nope. Kate, they need ya. Van Buren's the man. Van Buren was the man. I didn't hear anyone guess that. I'm keeping that candy, okay? This president's whole family had the initials LBJ, and I'm not even giving you options. Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lyndon Baines Johnson. If someone said LeBron James, I was going to kick you out too. Get this. I like where Lyndon Baines Johnson, the naming of his family, it's unique. You know, a J family can appreciate this kind of a thing. Lyndon Baines Johnson was his name. Lady Bird Johnson, his wife. Linda Bird Johnson. Lucy Baines Johnson. And even the dog, Little Beagle Johnson themselves. Isn't that something? This preacher can appreciate that there. LBJ. Okay, last one. This president is responsible for under God being added to the Pledge of Allegiance. Eisenhower. Eisenhower was the man. Dwight D. Eisenhower. Little presidential trivia to get this week started right, all right? As history will be made this week with an election that takes place there. So, fun icebreakers. I bet you there's one thing that all these presidents had in common, though. I don't know this for a fact. I can't put this and toss out candy to this question, but I bet you that all these presidents had at least one thing in common. And this one thing in common is each of these presidents was probably asked the question on their campaign trail, what are you going to do about the economy? Each and every president, that seems to be one of the major ticket items, no matter what ballot year, whether the economy's good or whether the economy's bad, each and every president is asked that question, what are you going to do about the economy there? The Republican side has the belief in free markets and letting the economy kind of take care of itself. The Democratic side has more of a regulation and taxes being based on income to a household in that way. There's different views, particularly between the parties, about the economy. But I'm here to speak, not prophetically, but just realistically, that both Republicans and Democrats one day will be wrong about the economy. Because there comes a day where the paper really is revealed for what it is, just paper that's printed on, where Wall Street's wealth will truly be worthless. I'm not speaking prophetically, I'm just speaking realistically, that there's going to come a day where the economic answers that work for this life aren't going to transfer over into the next life. And so that's really where the Bible comes to play. What is God's platform, God's economic platform for all of eternity, and what does that look like? Jesus himself, God in human flesh, God when he came to the planet to reveal to us and show us the way, what heaven's way looks like, he revealed this about heaven's economy and a charge to those in the midst of this economy with heaven's economy in mind. Jesus said, don't store up treasures here on earth where moth eats and rust destroys, where thieves break in and steal. Store up your treasures in heaven, where moss and rust cannot destroy and thieves don't break in and steal. Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will be also. If you're a member of this church, or if the church has your contact information, chances are you've already been prompted a month in advance that we would be talking about the economy this week, particularly how it relates to our personal stewardship. If you're a guest with us here today, we're really grateful that you're here with us, but know that the church's prime emphasis isn't to try to get your money. We really are working from a different economic standpoint. We don't invite people here just to get their money. But with that said, we do have this belief that how we manage our money really impacts how we relate to our God. And so each and every year, around this time of year, we as a church talk about money. Whether it's a ballot issue or not, we talk about money because money really impacts how we walk with God and what God is up to also in this world and mission to it. And Jesus reminds us an important truth about money. Money has a way of eluding itself here. There comes a day where moth and rust destroys or where thieves steal it. I had a conversation with someone this past week in the nursing home this past week, concerned about money, how they're going to pay the bills, because they had a good job leading up to this point, but eventually there hits a point where the bills just come in faster than what the income comes in. And so you either write it off in the will there and leave it for someone else behind, or a nursing home or insurance care or something that has a way of taking the money from you. The money, no matter what, in this life seems to sprout wings and elude us, no matter how much of it I have or how little of us we have there. And Jesus is getting at the heart of that with moth and rust destroying and thieves breaking in and stealing. Money is uncertain in this life. But he does say, store up your treasures in heaven. Now, the question I would have for Jesus and the question that we prompted in our stewardship letter this past year is, how in the world do you transfer over earth's income to heaven's bakes, you know? How do you do lay away the heaven's way? How do you store up your treasures in heaven? You know, I go to Krogan or I go to First National, and none of them are advertising how I can store up what I have here and lay it away for there. They're saying I can store away what I have here for here, but they don't have a plan that's from here to there. Jesus, maybe he's got a plan that way of how we can store up our treasures in heaven. And that's the interest, that's the curiosity, that's the question that I want to explore together today. How is it that we take what we have here and really lay it away to that eternal day? To lay it away heaven's way there. How do we store our treasure in heaven like Jesus infers there through Matthew 6. And to answer that question, I want to turn to Luke chapter 16. It's another teaching on Jesus. And it involves a business practice that Jesus is giving us an economic prescription for. He's going to build an economic platform off this parable he shares. So Bibles open, Luke 16. If you didn't bring one, there should be one in the pew located right before you. And if someone would shout out that page number so that we can all get there, that would be helpful today. 909. 909. Let's pick up in verse number 1 of chapter 16 as Jesus tells this parable of God's economic platform through this. Jesus said to his disciples, that's to his followers, he said, there was a rich man who had a steward. Can someone tell me what a steward is? What's a steward? Takes care of everything, like a manager. To steward someone is to not own it yourself, but to manage it for someone else there. And you receive some of the trickle-down effect from that managing position. The biblical position on this is that God is the owner of all things, and we are the stewards. That's the biblical picture of how this works there, how this planet and how income works. God is the owner of all things. Psalm 24 tells us, the earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. It belongs to God, okay? The earth, our lives, everything in it, it's the Lord's there. And yet God, in his ordering and in his design of the world, has given us, human beings, a place of responsibility, a place of managing, a place of stewarding all that he owns. Genesis 1:27, we looked at that verse last week. It kind of reveals the stewardship motif of how God crafted and created mankind to run. It says God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, both male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. God's handing over the keys in that statement. Fill the earth and subdue it. I created it all, and yet I'm giving it to you to manage, to fill, to subdue, rule over it. That's a stewarding word there. I'm giving you a charge, a rule, a reigning over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, over every living creature that moves around the ground. The biblical picture of how this planet works is that it all belongs to God. He's the creator. He owns the copyrights on every which thing. And yet within God's ownership, he's given us a special task, a design, a stewardship, a managing that which he's created. Jesus is telling a parable with this motif in mind. A rich man who owns all things and a steward. But the steward isn't doing his job, apparently, if we keep reading. There was a rich man who had a steward, and charges were brought to him that this man, the steward, was wasting his goods. The rich man gets some reports back. And it's not that this guy, this steward's an employee of the month. It's actually the exact opposite. He's wasting the goods. He's not doing his jobs. We're not told exactly how he's not doing his job. Maybe it was simply laziness. He wasn't doing his job because he was lazy. You know, there was something better on TV than following through with this purpose and this work that God had given him. Maybe that was it. Maybe he was being dishonest in some ways there. Pulling from the kitty, making his pockets a little bit bigger from the rich man's resources. Maybe that was it. I have a hunch, I have a theory that I think really what this guy's issue was, as we'll uncover from later on in the story, is that he didn't understand how this maker designed the makings. He didn't understand the rich man's design for how it relates to the economy. And this man, he probably was doing good on his spreadsheets, but he missed the whole purpose behind the designer's making, and that was that this making's bottom line, it wasn't bucks in the bank. It was really investing in people, and that this steward missed that call. Maybe we'll see that point expand or bubble up as we go through the story. Whatever it is, we're not told exactly what it is, but whatever it is, this man isn't doing his job as it relates to managing, to stewarding that which is entrusted to his care. And verse 2 says, he called him in. That's the rich man called the steward in. And he said to the steward, what is this that I've heard about you? Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you're no longer to be the steward. I've gotten some reports back, and they're not good reports. They're not promotions. They're not employee of the month kind of reports there. It's actually the exact opposite. Here's your pink slip. Your time, your days, your amount here is limited. Give an account to yourself, for you can no longer be the steward here. It's the reminder that we really will all stand before God one day to give an account. That's not a fear tactic, okay? It's really just meant to provide a dose of reality that each of us really does come to this day where we give an accounting before God himself. Romans 14 says, each of us will give a personal account to God. That's not just a financial account. That's our how we use the time that he's given us. That's how we've used the relationships that he's given us. That's how we use his finances that he's given us. All these different things. We'll have to give an account before God one day. The accounting day came up for the steward in verse 2. In verse 3 says, the steward said to himself, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the stewardship away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. He realizes he's weak and he's prideful. How's that for some self-awareness there for the steward? I think verse 3 is the turning point in the story, really. And the turning point for the story is him coming to an awareness that he's weak and prideful. I'm too weak to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. Verse 4, I've decided what to do so that people may receive me into their houses when I'm put out of the stewardship. He's got a plan. The plan's going to be a little twisted there. We're going to see in just a moment here. But I think the turning point is really in verse 3, where he realizes his weak and pridefulness there. That's some characteristics that God can work with. Not the characteristics God necessarily desires to give. He really does want us to experience strength. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He wants us to experience that, but first we got to realize our own personal weakness before we can access the power of Christ at work in us. He really does want us to experience pride, the good sense of pride, the pride that God's put in us, but the pride that God desires to experience comes by way of humility, humbly bowing our knee before him here. So that's the progression. We got to come to terms with our own weakness and our own pride in the wrong ways before we can access the strength of God in that humbling, prideful way that God desires to build us up as we bow the knee to him. And so I think verse 3 in many ways is a turning point, and it hatches a plan in verse number 4. He's got a plan. Let's pick up the plan in verse 5. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first one, how much do you owe my master? He replied, 100 measures of oil. And so he said to him, take your bill, sit down, and quickly write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest servant for his shrewdness. The scene unfolds of what the steward was doing with some of the clients of the master. The master finally re-enters the scene in verse 8, and it says, the master commended the dishonest steward for his shrewdness, For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of the light. And I tell you, this is Jesus speaking, I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous mammon. Mammon is a word for money itself. It's a Semitic word for money and riches in Jesus' day. Make for yourselves friends by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal habitations. Say what, Jesus? Is anyone else confused in this house about that? What is Jesus saying through this parable? Why is he using this parable? It's not like what we're used to in the parables of Jesus, right? We're expecting the parable of the Good Samaritan, where someone's showing compassion to someone else. Why is he commending a dishonest steward in this? What is going on between these lines? You kind of caught how the story unfolded, right? This master is rich because there's a lot of people who owe him something in this. One owes 100 gallons of oil. Don't know if it's motor oil or olive oil or essential oil, just a lot of oil, okay, that's being owned. And this steward says, write it off, make it 80 or make it 50 in that one. The next guy owns a lot of wheat there. Once again, not told exactly what type of wheat, but he says, mark your bill down to 80 bushels there. And then Jesus enters the scene by way of the narrative of the person of the master, and the master actually commends, verse 8, did you see it? The master commended the dishonest steward for his shrewdness. Say, what? You know what commend means, right? Commend means to applaud, to appreciate, to stand in an ovation, really, at what this guy has done. Why is the master commending this dishonest steward who just told people to X off what they owed and to mark it down, the debt that they had to be repaid? What's going on there? It needs to be noted that the master is not commending the dishonest steward for his dishonesty. He's commending him specifically for that shrewdness. To be shrewd means to be wise. It means to be prudent. And so that's what the rich man, this is what the ruler is commending and standing in ovation, this wisdom, this prudence, this shrewdness. Time and time again, Jesus is applauding shrewdness. He says in Matthew 10:16, he calls his people there to be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves, to be as wise as snakes. Once again, in Matthew 7, he says, therefore, anyone who hears these words of mine, this is after the Sermon on the Mount, this is the last teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, anyone who hears these words of mine and puts them in practice is a wise man. That's that same word used here for shrewdness in the RSV translation. That person is a shrewd man who's built his house on the rock. There seems to be a correlation between hearing and heeding, following through with the words of Jesus, and a life of wisdom, of shrewdness. And the master sees shrewdness through the example of what this steward was doing in the story. So what is it? What is it exactly that the steward is doing that's showing shrewdness? I think the answer is found in verse 8. The answer is found in verse 9, rather. Jesus' closing comments on this story, at least, he says, I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails you, they may receive you into eternal habitations. What Jesus is commending is that this person invested in people. He finally caught that glimpse. That's why I said at the outset, what I think the bottom line of this rich man, it wasn't the bottom line of how big is my bank account. The bottom line of this rich man was investing in people. And he finally gets it, that this steward somehow, some way caught the connection, the need to invest in people. And I think that's what prompts Jesus' closing command in verse 9, make friends with your finances, in essence. Look for ways with your money to make friends for, to invest in people's lives. Because I think it answers the question, how do we store up treasures in heaven? Right? That's the question we said we're coming back to. Matthew 6, what we opened up with. How do we lay away heaven's way? I think Jesus gives us that answer in verse number 9. We lay away our treasures in heaven, not by investing in banks, but by investing in human beings. Because it's people, not possessions, that carry over into eternity. You catch that? I've read the Bible through. I've never seen a mention of First National or Krogan or First Merit or any of those bank chains having an establishment in heaven. But you know what I have seen in the picture of heaven through the Bible? People. People before the throne of God. See, it's people, not possessions, that carry over into paradise. And so I think Jesus' teaching on this, what he's applauding, what he's commending this steward, is that the steward finally got it. It's not about the spreadsheets. It's not about the bank accounts. It's about investing in lives, investing in people, investing maybe even specifically in people who carry a huge debt, who realize how big of a debtor they are in terms of where they're at in this stage in life. The call is to invest in people, sinners, in debt in their walk with God, and to bring them up into an eternal heritage with this God who loves them, delights in them, and is reaching out to them through us, his people on earth today. Hold that thought in the back of your mind, okay? Push the pause button just for a moment. Al knows, uh-oh, this is just roaring up. We're going somewhere else. Don't pause too much. Let's go, verse 10. We won't pause too much. We'll actually fast forward through verse 10 there. But I think it gives a little bit of some economic advice for what follows with this parable itself. These are Jesus' comments here. He who is faithful with very little is faithful also in much. And he who is dishonest in very little is dishonest in much. If you then have not been faithful with unrighteous mammon, who will entrust you with true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money, God and mammon. The Pharisees, ironically, the religious group that Jesus is talking to, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all this, and they scoffed at Jesus. But Jesus said to him, "You are those who justify yourselves before men." You look good around people, in other words. You justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is exalted among men is an abomination in the sight of God. You might be fooling people, but you can't fool God, is Jesus' bottom line statement, particularly where it comes to this banking in mind. So what are some economic principles? What is God's economic platform with this parable and those concluding statements in mind? What is the platform that God would build off of? I won't pause too long, Al, I promise you, but we just want to fly through at least three things of what God's saying about the economy. And first, God says, in reverse order, it's either God or green. God or green being money itself. Jesus said, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon, both God and money. The human heart was designed in such a way where only one can sit on the throne of it. You got one heart, only one can claim the throne of your heart. And so the question is, what has your heart? Is it money or is it God? Because you can't have both sitting on the same heart there. It's either one or the other. With that said, it doesn't mean that a Christian doesn't have money. But what it does mean is the money that you have is really under God's ownership then. See, a Christian can still have finances, but they realize the finances aren't theirs. It's ultimately God's. And so whatever God says about those finances, then that impacts how I spend my finances. If you sit and God starts stirring on your heart on behalf of some mission or some organization, you feel like your heart is connected with the heart of someone speaking forward, and you can picture the ways where you have something to give in this way, God starts to tug on that heart in that way, then you start to give in that way because you realize it's not ultimately yours, it's God's. And so if God's asking for it, then God's getting it because it's his, because God's on the throne of my heart. It means if God has a principle in his book, it means if God has a principle in his book that says a certain amount is to go to my work, the first part of that is to go to my work, it means that God has access to that first part, which he does, which he has in his word. They call it a tithe, and it's repeated throughout Scripture. Deuteronomy 14 says you must set aside a tithe of your crops. It's an agricultural society. Their wealth, their paycheck was by way of the crops. And Jesus says, of that wealth, of that paycheck, of your crops, a tithe of it, which is 10% of it, 10% of it, 1/10 of all the crops you harvest each year, bring this tithe to the designated place of worship, the place the Lord your God chooses for his name to be honored, and eat it there in his presence. This applies to your tithes of grain, new wine, olive oil, firstborn males, your flocks, your herds there. There's supposed to be something about bringing this into the presence of God with this promise at the end of it. Doing this will teach you always to fear the Lord your God. You see, there's a connection between our giving and our worshiping. Some of us don't feel close with God because we haven't given God full ownership of all that's on our hearts. We've been trying to divide our hearts in different ways instead of God giving God our whole hearts, including that financial part of our hearts too, where Jesus says it plainly, you can't serve both God and money, God or green. Giving open access to God in all areas of life, including our financial aspect, is an important platform on how we grow closer in our walk with God and also what God would expect lovingly from us as well. There's more about that tithe in mind and God's promise in the wake of that tithe too. You see, God just doesn't take. He really is the giver. One of his first titles is the giver of life. You see, God doesn't demand something for no reason there. He desires to give something better than which he's even demanded. But you only find that when you're obedient in that which he's demanded. You only find that when you're obedient in that which he's demanded. Second point of God's economic platform that Jesus teaches us, he teaches us that earth's possessions are really heaven's preparations. Earth's possessions are heaven's preparations. And he says it this way, he who is faithful in very little is faithful also in much. He who is dishonest in very little is dishonest also in much. If dishonesty is there, the only thing that changes is the value. If faithfulness is there, the only thing that changes is the value itself. The faithfulness, the characteristic itself remains the same. If you have not been faithful in unrighteous mammon, in earthly wealth, if you've not been faithful to God in the ways of earthly wealth, who's going to entrust you with the true riches of heaven itself? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, if we really are stewards of all that God's given us, our abilities to earn it there, the jobs that he's placed us, whatever it is, if we've not been faithful in that which is another's, who's going to pitch you that which is in charge of your own? There's a connection, there's a correlation between what we have now and our preparations for our task in all of eternity. Earth's possessions are heaven's preparations. And so the question needs to remain in the room, how can I be more faithful to God in this area of finances now? Because I realize that there's a correlation between what I'm doing now with my finances to what will be entrusted with me in the thereafter. As I've shared with many of you before, oftentimes when I'm in the car, I have it tuned into Moody Radio. Moody Radio is a Christian radio broadcasting out of Cleveland and Sandusky and different places like that. The database is from Chicago itself. And on one such trip to Toledo, just within the last 2 weeks, I heard someone on the radio in the afternoon by the name of, I can't even think of his name myself, Ron Blue. He wrote a book, Master Your Money. On the back of your message outline are some of the things that Ron Blue was discussing on that day. And it just stuck out to me. Ron Blue was asked to appear before Congress in the 90s. And Congress asked him the question, what would you tell as a financial advisor, what would you tell the American family? And Ron Blue, before that point, had written a book on biblical principles of how you manage your money. How does this work best, this thing of finances? And so he shared some of that at Congress in the 90s, and he shared some of it on the radio broadcast that day. Five things of what it means to be faithful to God with our money. The first thing he says, spend less than you earn. In other words, live within your means. Financial advice of what does it look like to being faithful to God with our earthly possessions, realizing that our earthly possessions really do correlate to our heavenly possessions. He says, be faithful or live within your means. Live on less than you earn. Secondly, he says, avoid the use of debt because debt mortgages the future. The Bible puts it this way, the borrower is slave to the lender. The borrower is slave to the lender. And so as much as possible, you want to limit those loans. You want to limit that being a slave to the lender. Avoiding debt is important. Have personal general cash flow margin that's set aside for emergencies. Because emergencies happen, right? So he says, anticipate emergencies and have money reserves ready for such times. Have some pool of money set aside so that when the car breaks down, you've got a little bit in the bank already. Or when the boiler goes on in the house or whatever it is there, to have some set aside so an emergency doesn't become the emergency in that moment. Fourthly, set up long-term goals financially to see how the short-term spending impacts long-term goals. In other words, have a spending plan. Have some goals set in the future. Dream together as spouses. Dream together as a family of where you want to be someday or what you want to do or a vacation you want to set aside, and see how stopping at the gas station and picking up a Mountain Dew impacts that long-term goal of setting money aside to go to Hawaii or whatever it may be there. You got to see that correlation between short-term spending and long-term goals. And then fifthly and lastly, he says, give generously. The only way to break the power of money is to give money. Give generously. The only way to break the power of money is to give money. I have a hunch that the reason why God is so adamant about giving 10% to God isn't because God needs 10%. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. God doesn't need 10%. He's got unlimited reserves at his disposal. Why does God command giving so much, though, in Scripture? I think it's because he realizes the grip that money has on so many lives, not just in America, but down through the dawn of ages, and that the only way to break money's grip is to give money, to be generous in that way. And so God's call to give money is really a call to reclaim your life so that you own your possessions instead of your possessions owning you. God's laws are always for our ultimate good. And so whenever he commands something, it isn't commanding something just for the sake of commanding it, just because God likes to hear himself talk. That's not it. God only commands something because he realizes how this human creature he made best runs. And so money gripping lives so often, the only way to break it is to give it. God will command the giving of it so that we can experience the freedom from it, to not be owned, not to be possessed by our possessions themselves. Good financial advice for this life, managing wealth here, because we realize the managing of our wealth here really does impact the managing of wealth and what we're entrusted to for our eternal purposes in heaven. And then lastly, that point I want to return to, maybe the most important point of today, it's that eternal investments, the only way to lay away treasure from earth to heaven is by investing in people. Eternal investments, the only way you'll find that you can store up treasures in heaven, the only way to make an eternal transaction is really by investing in people. Jesus said at the start, don't store up your treasures on earth where moths and rust eat them and destroys them and where thieves break in and steal. No, store your treasures in heaven, for where moths and rust can't destroy and where thieves can't break in and steal, wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will be also. How do you lay away the heaven's way? How do you make an eternal transaction? Krogan, First National, First Merit, PNC, they won't know how to make this eternal transaction. But God himself in his word has told us, I believe through this parable, how to make that eternal transaction. And it's by investing in people. It's by what Jesus said in verse 9 of our parable. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal habitations. You catch the correlation between making friends and eternity? There's a connection. There's a connection. There's a reason why we've been given what we've been giving. And it's not so that we can amass wealth. It's not so that the spreadsheets look good in our favor. It's so that we can genuinely look for ways to invest in people. Invest in people by finding ways through our investments to link them, to connect them to this God who created them and cares for them. That's the purpose behind what we have. As a church, that's the purpose behind what we do. We really genuinely want to, as a church, finance committee, ad council, church family, as a church, we want to find that connection between investing in people in every act that we do in this place. We don't just pack shoeboxes, buy toys. We want to invest in making disciples of nations. And so we give them a gift with the hopes of communicating the gift. We spend our resources to pack boxes and to pay postage, to send it around the world, not because we're trying to get rich or because we're just looking for something to give to, but because we're trying to lay away an eternal investment. A gift communicating the gift. We don't just want to pay electric bills and gas bills. We want to provide space where people can come every single day of the week and learn about a God who cares for them and is reaching for them. Whether it's through the daycare, Monday through Friday, Sunday morning worship, Bible studies, whatever it is, we will gladly pay gas and electricity, not for the sake of feeding a pig, but for the sake of genuinely trying to connect lives, to have a space set aside where people can connect with their Creator. Each and everything that we do in this place, each and everything that passes through these plates is really meant to be an investment in people, in lives, because we realize we can't take it with us, but the only way we can take it with us is by taking them with us. It's not possessions, it's people that passes over into paradise, and so it's people that we need to be looking for opportunities to invest in through the church family and through our personal lives as well as an act of worship to God together. Make sense? The last of the tough issues, huh? I'm sure we'll find another tough issue to cover next week there. But God's platform, God's economy, God's design behind how these finances are meant to flow, it's meant to flow in a faith-filled way that points people's lives closer to a walk with Him, including in our lives by giving over to Him.